Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel. Here is a motion picture film, 1,000 feet, 16,000 separate photographs.
Welcome, everybody.
How long before the bug bit you into wanting to get into the industry? Was it a night at stand up? Was it sketch comedy? Like, I mean, I read one of your bios that quoted you being you're the bastard love child of Dave Chappelle and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Right. Larry David.
David. Oh yeah. I love those two guys.
Yeah, that's insane, yeah. Man. So like, when because. That's the thing, is that like I do this on the side, right? It's not something I'm jumping into full time unless, you know, someone backs up a Brinks truck and makes me want to change my life inside out for it. So the day job pays for the dream. But when did you take the professional plunge into it, so to speak? I mean, you still got the gig, but like, when did you start pitching? When did you start wanting to get into the game?
It was for a while. I think right after when I was getting out of college, I was doing music production stuff. And I remember a girl I was dating named Laura. She had tickets for me to go see The Roots. And I remember I had a regular day job. I think I forgot what it was at that time, but I just didn't like it. I was out of school. I'd had a day job. I'm like, I hate this. And I never liked talking in front of people, but I always knew I could write as good a joke as anything I've seen on TV. I'm like, I can write at least that good. So instead of going to The Roots, I was like, I'm going to this open mic night. I think it was Riddles in Orland Park, in a little south of the city of Chicago, just outside Chicago. And after that, I'd go there every week, and I started going to spots in the city, and I'd be going all around the city. That's where I met, like, I'm still friends with, like, Hannibal Buress, TJ Miller, Kumail. We were all kind of in the same age.
Kumail Nanjiani, is that who we're talking about? Wow,
yeah,
exactly. Man, that's a circle to come up in.
Exactly. And who else was there? Deion Cole. It was a lot of good guys.
Oh my God, that's fun.
Yeah. And so as it was going around the city, when I started, Hannibal was like the guy you didn't like. He was like, everyone's like, this guy's different. He's really good. TJ was, his improv was through the roof. Kumail was dope. And I was just starting. So as those guys moved out, it became like in my last year or so, like 2008 from Chicago, people were like, you're the next guy that's going to blow up. That's what all comedians kept saying. So I chose, was I going to move to New York or LA? And I picked LA because I want to do more writing stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And that's when I went full. But at that time, I was touring throughout the Midwest a lot. Like 3 out of 4 weekends a month, I was probably gone somewhere doing shows. Even while I kept the construction gig, which was, it was funny how I got out of that gig. It was...
Do tell.
Actually, yeah. Well, first of all, no one knew I did comedy because I didn't want anyone to know I did comedy.
I hear that.
A couple of the guys, electricians, MJ Electric. I'm in a meeting one day, and I get a call on my BlackBerry, and it's one of the guys at MJ. Yeah, that's how long ago it was. One of the guys at MJ Electric was like, hey, Haji, are you a comedian? I said, what? What are you talking about? He's like, we just saw some of your clips on YouTube. Why don't you come to our trailer real quick?
Fuck.
And I was like, fuck. Yeah, exactly. And I went over there, and they're like, oh, man, you're pretty funny. This guy's like, we won't tell anyone. We obviously, you know, you don't want people to know. So they were real cool about it. But I go over their trailer, and we just talk about, like, either Family Guy or whatever's on TV or whatever funny stuff's going on. So that kind of happened. And then I'd be gone so many, like, as soon as I'd leave work at, like, 3:30, I'd be out in Michigan. I'd be going to Indiana or somewhere to do gigs. And as our project was ending, they kept trying to get me to go move to another spot. We had a contract with ComEd that was up. So they're like, you want to go to Appleton, Wisconsin? You want to go to somewhere else, Southern Illinois? And I was like, nope. I want to go to none of those places. So eventually my boss, Paul Ives, I had rejected like 4 or 5 places. He was like, Haji, what's going on here? You see the writing on the wall. If you don't go one of these places, you won't have a job. He's like, you can just tell me straight up what's going on. It won't matter. I just want to know what's going on. And I told him, I'm like, yeah, I've been doing comedy and writing for a while now. I can basically pay all my bills by doing stand-up, and I'm probably going to move to New York or L.A. within the next year. So that's why I don't want to move to these other places. And he was like, oh, okay. I won't tell them exactly that, but I understand. Good luck. And I was like, okay, cool. So after that point, I think I was let go the day after Obama was elected.
Okay.
Six months later, I moved to LA, And that's when I was like full bore into everything in LA for comedy scene.
So that's like 2009, 2010, right around there.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think that may have led to, like, were you afraid at all? Were you losing your shit? Like, you know, you're packing up, you're rolling up a stake and you're going to Vegas, essentially, right? And who knows what's going to happen?
Pretty much. But the way I am, like, I think I had like 20 or 30 grand because I always live under my means. So like at that point, and because I was let go, I was collecting unemployment.
Okay.
And then Obama extended the unemployment. So I was like, oh, I'm good. Yeah. I worked really good out here for like 2 years. I don't need to do anything. Like, I remember I was doing a sketch, a CBS diversity comedy sketch thing in LA. I was just after I got signed with 3 Arts and CAA for representation. And I remember we're doing it. And what's his name? London Brown. He was on Ballers. He was in it. Tiffany Haddish was with me. Fortune Feimster. Justin Hires, who was in, I know, a couple of 21 Jump Street movies. But I think Tiffany Haddish was like obviously the star of that. Blew up. But we were doing, I think we were near the end of that sketch comedy thing. We're like doing our final performances. And I remember London asked me like, what do you do? What do you do for a living? I'm like, I work as a bouncer in Venice like once or twice a week. And he's like, does that pay the bills? I'm like, oh no, I'm collecting unemployment. Thank you, Obama. And he's like, well, what happens when your unemployment runs out? I'm like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know. And I don't really want to think about it right now. That was really it. And I remember that got me thinking like, I better start getting like some kind of regular-ish job. And that's how I got into bouncing in LA more.
Okay, so you get I want to get into the bouncing stuff, but I got to like, is the LA shock as shocking as it was back then? Like, I imagine you get there and you've got one interpretation of it in your mind. Like, you're going to roll up, you're going to pitch, you're going to step into studios. It's all going to, they're just going to open up, you know, the gates and here comes Haji. But like, what was your first week in LA like, and any struggles, any shocks?
There was a couple, it wasn't really shock of like the scene or anything like that. Like, I didn't really know anyone in LA full time at that time. Hannibal would pop in because he had either shows or some TV or movie stuff. So I'd hang out with him a little bit. But I think it was more just like the picture people have of Hollywood and what it is not what it really is. Like, I was going to, this was actually the first week. I remember there was a kind of biggish open mic called Pig and Whistle on Hollywood Boulevard. And that's where I met Gerard Carmichael, just had moved out there. And, it was a bunch of other people. I'm trying to think of no other big names, but like, nah, Gerard's kind of big now. So, yeah, exactly. So I remember I was walking up to the Pig and Whistle. I had to park my car and walk about a block. And there's like behind the Pig and Whistle, there's like a old school. I don't know if it was still open. They have like these big platform stands where like there'd be a big gargoyle, but like the gargoyles weren't there. And as I'm walking up, there's a bum sitting on one of those. I'm like, why is he sitting up there? And as I get closer, I'm realizing he's not sitting. This guy was taking a shit on the pillar. And it's like 6 o'clock and it's still bright out. I'm like, this guy's taking a shit like 80 feet away from one of the like Walk of Fame stars, like Dolly Parton's name's like 75 feet away. And this guy's taking a shit like 12 feet in the air. And I'm just like, okay, this is not the place I thought it was.
Welcome to La La Land, motherfucker. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the mm-hmm. bouncing thing. Let's get into that. Took the job bouncing just because it was good money.
No, was,
like, how did that land?
Like, I was out there for maybe 4 months or so, and I had another comedian buddy of mine, Michael, who had written on the first Arsenio and then the new Arsenio. He's older than me. He came out and stayed with me for a little bit. He had another buddy living in Venice who worked at Howell's Bar and Grill, which is right on Abbot Kinney in Venice. I don't think it's there anymore. So we went to go visit him. His buddy was bouncing there, and Michael just dropped like, hey, Haji's out here. He's a big black dude like you. Think you could get some work as a bouncer? And I was like, I didn't ask him for it. He just volunteered that. And I was like, oh, that's not a bad idea. And the other guy was like, yeah, sure. Come by on Monday at so-and-so o'clock. We're all black, and I'll talk you through it. You can be like a fill-in guy. And that's how I started bouncing in Venice over there.
Now, bouncing, I think it's territorial, right? Bouncing in Winnipeg, nowhere near like bouncing in Calgary. Bouncing in Chicago, nowhere near bouncing like in LA. So, like, what was your first, like, what the fuck is happening? How am I here? How did I land here?
It really wasn't. At first, it was just kind of a cool gig because that Abbot Kinney is a lot of money. They're like, Robert Downey Jr.'s house is right down the street. I know it was Jack Nicholson's, Angelica Houston's house was right over there. So it was like a lot of big ballers like stuff. And I saw when I was there, like Jalen Rose was having dinner in there when I walked in the first time. Michael Keaton used to drop in there all the time. And he always forgot to pay for his meal and drinks. Like genuinely, he would forget. And the bartender would be like, you know, you didn't play it last time. You're like, oh, I'm so sorry. You just slammed down a wad of cash and be like, my bad. I can forgive. And one time he actually did it while I was there. He's like, I get kind of used to people not making me pay because I'm Batman. And this is like before Christopher Nolan's like whole series came out. So he was known as like the most Batman around besides Adam West. So I guess he got a lot of free meals and drinks out of it.
No shit.
It was more like a lot of stargaze. I remember Paul Giamatti was there with like his, I don't know if his wife or parents. And I just remember, I really just love his acting. And when I was at Powell's, and I remember I gave him a look, like I wanted to say like, I really like your, I think you're really good. And he just gave me a stern look like, don't fuck with me. I'm with my family. Do not say anything. And I was like, you're a good actor. I didn't say that, but I was like, that look, I didn't have to say anything. I was like, okay, I left him alone. Let him do his thing.
That's that badass motherfucker from Billions giving you that look across the room, right? Yeah. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, because like you come from your life and you end up in the City of Angels, you end up in La La Land, and then you see Paul Giamatti, you know, the masterful performance from Sideways sitting across from you. So is there like a check that you kind of put yourself through where you're like, okay, now I'm in this room, I was in that room? Like, I'm always interested in the inner workings of it and how people acclimatize to it, because it is so insane and it is so built on so many weird principles that I wonder how much changes in you and you react to it.
I think for me, my inclination was more to just be more quiet and just don't, like, in general, I'm not a fan of people on the whole. So it wasn't like a ton of work for me to like get used to that, be like, okay, I'm standing here like at a party. Like I remember, well, this is jumping ahead, but I was at a party, Eric Andre's party, and right next to me is Jack Black. And I was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, I heard like a voice I recognized. I was like, oh, it's Jack Black. Okay. And I just try and be yourself.
Which leads me back to the bouncing thing. Like you are the eye in the sky. You're the guy who sees everything, reacts accordingly, fuck around and find out all the cliches you can throw a stick at a bouncer at. But you ended up wanting to write a book about it. And the idea of going, like Kitchen Confidential rings to mind by Anthony Bourdain, right? A bird's eye view of the restaurant industry, a bird's eye view of the world of bouncing. When did the book, forgive me, I forget the title. What was the title of the book again? Hey Doorman. When did Hey Doorman, like how many weeks into bouncing were you like, I need to write this shit down? Or there's a book here. Like how did you flush all that out?
It's a good juxtapose. But basically, I think I was bouncing for maybe 4 years before I even started thinking about it. And what happened was when I first started, I was just like, this is just a go-between job. I won't have to worry about it. Because as I was getting that, when I first got it, I think 2 months later, I had a pitch meeting with Comedy Central for my own show. That didn't work out. And then like 6 months after that, I had signed the 3 Arts and CAA. So I'm not thinking about this as a book or anything, but the way my mind works, incidents that happen, I remember them vividly. If it's like anything like hypocritical or doesn't make sense or it's a little off, I remember those things, like the taste, the smell, I remember everything about it. So it never, none of these stories that ever left my mind. Like I remember, like, yeah. So like, I remember the first time, like I came into work, they were calling me as I'm driving in, like, you need to get here. There's about to be a fight. And I'm like, well, I'm like 15 minutes away. Can't someone else deal with this? I can't get here any faster. And I remember this, and I get there and they're like, deal with these guys. And I'm like, okay. And I've been bouncing for like 2 weeks. And I come in there and it's like, one guy's like 250. The other guy's like 270 and they're like nose to nose. And I'm like, okay, I'm 6'3", about 210. I'm like, I don't get paid enough for this. But I just talked to these guys and like talked them down and got them some drinks. And I was like, oh, cool. And I remember thinking when it was over, like, man, I think like guys in LA are like dogs in LA. Only the little ones start shit. And I remember having that thought. And that's like the first story I think I put down in the book. years later. So it was after I had like gone through the gauntlet of like Hollywood and not working out, because TV writing is just as superficial and bigoted as any other industry. So as I'm like having all these stories and I'm bouncing more on the weekends, I'm like, I should turn this into a book. And I told people some couple of stories and they're like, yeah, that's a good fucking story. And I'm like, okay, that's when I started jotting it down. That was probably around 2013 or 2014 or somewhere around there when I started writing them.
Is it more of a collection of stories, or is there a fluent narrative that you're going through, or are you being satirical as you're writing it? Like, what was your,
mine
what's your
is more a little bit of satire, but each story is about 90-95% dead on accurate. It's just a little bit of the ordering. So each story will be like, one story is called Naked Masturbator. Basically, the synopsis is,
What are the cliff notes? Yeah. I'm confused.
It was basically just like, I'm at the front one night, it's a Friday night, busy bar in West Hollywood. The actual bar in that case was Bar Lubitsch, right on Santa Monica Boulevard. And one of the bartenders, the only male bartender, Mike, comes out and he just starts laughing. He's like, yo, you got to deal with something in the bathroom. I'm like, what is it? He's like, you'll see. I go in there, there's a line coming out and there's like two big stalls, but I'm just tall enough to see over. So I walk up to the top of the stall. I look down. This is this fat guy on a busy night, by the way, packed, no shirt on, dick in one hand, phone in the other, just jerking off. And there's like eight other guys like out the door in the like trying to take a piss. And I'm just like, yo, slam my door, get your fucking shirt on and get the fuck out. He's like, what? I only took my shirt off because it's hot. I'm like, that makes no fucking sense. Get it on and get the fuck out. Like that's what has the, those things resonate in my mind. I'm like, okay, I can write down every nuance of this whole sequence of events.
Was it tough? Because you knew them and like you remember everything so vividly, was it tough writing them out even though they were so intimate to you?
Extremely easy. The only quasi difficult point was just like taking the stories that might seem mundane and making them more, I guess, theatrical or cinematic. So a lot of my comedy, I'll reference a bunch of different movies that maybe resonate with this scene or who this person seems like. So it'll be a lot of TV references, movie references, all through everything, a lot of music references. So that was probably the only difficult part, but the actual sequence of events of what transpired is blindingly easy to me. It's the easiest writing I've probably ever done.
The pitch process. That must feel like a huge song and dance where you're just paraded out in front of a bunch of people and you have to make them all bite. Like, what was your first pitch like?
I remember the first full pitch I had was the one with Comedy Central out there. It was Tony Maggin. I don't know if she's still with Comedy Central, or one other guy named Sam. And at the time, I had a roommate then, and he had worked for the same company that produced the Saw movies. He was like low down on the ranking or whatever at the company. But he had been in a lot of pitch meetings and I never pitched. So I was like, why don't you come pitch this thing with me? I had already written the pilot. But he's like, oh, we should do this, this, and this. And we had basically flip cards of like describing the characters and showing the main guy looks like Jason Segel, or so-and-so looks like this will be Jessica Alba or whatever. So it was a little bit of a song and dance, which as a writer is kind of annoying to me. Like even right now I'm working with a writer buddy I'm coming up with a treatment for Hey Doorman, and he pitches a lot. And I think he has one golfing show that's got picked up, but it's because of the strike. They're kind of biding time and waiting for stuff. But, since he pitches a lot, he's given me advice on how to really sell yourself in the writing of it and for pitching. And I don't like that at all. I'm a writer. I'm just like, just if you like the idea, pay me to write the pilot. If you don't like the pilot, oh well. But this is, I write, so let me just go ahead and knock this out and you guys do what you got to do. Like that's kind of my mentality. So I've had to revise that a little bit because I have to put on a little bit of a song and dance or put stuff in there like, why are you the person to write this? But for the Hey Doorman thing, it's easy. He was telling me, it's like, this is autobiographical. This is your life. So it's basically 10 years of your life in LA. I'm like, yeah, I'm the only dude who should write it. This is a 10-year chunk of my life. So it's easy to pitch this one, but everything else, because I used to write a lot of fiction, I don't like pitching. in general.
It just seems so, like, I'm horrible at self-promotion. I just don't like it. I'm like, hey, look at me, look at this, look at what I can do. Like it, and I'm an only child. You'd think I'd be born with that skill, but you know, it's, and I just imagine, I'm like, okay, if you ever want to pitch an idea, you sit down with the suits and I mean, we've seen every sketch out there of it going down, but is it as remotely close to some of, like, is it you're paraded into a conference room and you're like, hi, I'm Haji, and like,
Yeah,
is it,
it's very
oh.
similar to the Seinfeld kind of pitch, where, but
Oh.
usually everyone, every kind of pitch meeting I've been in, no one, like the executives, they're not in suits like they were with Seinfeld. Maybe that was just NBC or what they were
Yeah.
presenting. They're never in full suits, and they're a little more looser than that. But that sort of like hive mentality, where like they're waiting for one person to laugh and then everyone else joins and laughs, like that is there. That is completely there, 1,000%. Like usually they'll say, hey, just have fun, pitch us your idea, blah blah blah, this and that. They're not as stiff, but they don't really laugh at that much. They don't want to seem, I guess they probably don't want to seem too impressed, but they think they're gonna get a big contract or whatever. But is there there's
Yeah.
a I don't know, there's something about it, there's like a disconnect, because I think they're thinking about, how do we sell this? Can I sell this to someone? And you're just thinking like, I want to present a good idea and put on a good performance of this idea. And they're just thinking like, how do I sell this to my bosses? How much is this going to cost? So there's a natural disconnect, because they're more business sided and I'm more artist sided. So those things naturally just kind of clash to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of what is being exposed right now, and what the general public should have more of an idea of is that the people who greenlight your shit don't know anything about
Oh,
making it.
no, 100%.
So.
My best story, I remember Louis C.K. talked about this when he was pitching his show, the FX show, Louis. He said there was
Yeah.
an executive he met, and he told him like, look, he heard the pitch. He's like, halfway through the pitch, I heard, he's like, done, stop. I love this idea. I love your world. I think you're a brilliant comedian. I can give you $150,000 to shoot this thing right now. He said, if you want, I can take this to my boss, but I'm letting you know right now, Louis, that my boss, he does not understand your comedy. He doesn't understand comedy in general, and you're gonna have to pitch the fuck out of him in order to get this show. Or you can do this for
Wow.
150 and let it grow from there. And Louis said, done. 150, and you're gonna leave me alone? He's like, yeah, you can shoot it, edit it, write it, do what you need to do, but we can only give you 150. He's like, okay, done.
Hence why it's black and white. Hence why it's 20 minutes,
Exactly.
right? Like he worked within the confines of the budget. But yeah, that's autonomy. That's the ability to make shit and be like, get the fuck out, keep your notes to yourself. Thank you very much,
Precisely,
right?
yeah.
Oh, man. And I, you know, yeah, the guys on the show are like, we should pitch Netflix. And I'm like, the devil? Fuck that. I'm not going to give this. Like, they won't even tell me how well I'm doing if I sell this to them. Like, that's not something I want to live
Oh.
with. Am I doing a good job? We think you are, but it doesn't matter what you know. What? Like, that whole metric thing is
Yeah.
beyond me.
I know a couple guys who pitched to Netflix, and like he said there's no real artistic control. They're basically just like, they give you a bunch of money to do it. This is like 7 years ago, but they just give you a bunch of money and they leave you alone, but they have no idea artistically what you're doing. They just have a bunch of money and say, okay, it's greenlit, go make your show. But they don't have any artistic input. Like HBO, they have actual artists who are like, go through. Like I had a buddy who was working for a newsroom with Sorkin, and he said in season two, they read the first two or three scripts that he had for season two, and the executives had a meeting with Sorkin, were like, these scripts aren't good enough, we need them to be better. And I was like, holy shit, you told Sorkin, Aaron Sorkin, these scripts aren't good enough. And they said, to his credit, he didn't get mad. He's like, okay, I'll go back and rewrite them. And after he wrote them, they're like, these are great, go knock out the rest, keep going.
Interesting. Even Sorkin needs to be pushed around a little bit sometimes to get the gold out of him. Wow. No, I, when, like, if you could get a dream sketch show or a stand up on Netflix tomorrow, what do you think you'd take first? Would you rather have the writing or would you rather have the stand up?
I'll probably take the stand up, but only because if everything else falls apart, if I have a special on, I can tour no matter what. While with the sketch show, you're locked into that. That's the show. It doesn't really necessarily as much lead to you being able to tour. But if you have an hour special up, you can tour no matter what. Your agents can dump you. Managers can dump you. You can still book gigs and book quality headlining gigs with a special up. So that's the higher floor of the two to me.
Yeah. It's passive income. It keeps coming back to you, right? Where if the show doesn't, yeah. So Bastard Love Child of Larry David and Dave Chappelle. What are your Dave Chappelle show moments?
a couple of them. I remember, I remember when I first saw him on, not for what it's worth, Killing Him Softly. And I remember he had the joke about Monica Lewinsky where he's like, I always wanted to be famous, but I never thought about being so famous that someone sucks your dick and then they're famous. And I remember being like, I heard 1,000 Lewinsky jokes. I'm like, I've never heard one that fucking good ever. So he was all that put him on my radar like immediately. A few years later, I was in college. We went to go see Undercover Brother. And I remember he just stole it. He was killing it. And a girl I was with that was in our group, she walked out like 30 minutes in. She's like, I find this movie offensive. And the rest of us were like, okay, whatever. This is hilarious. And then a little bit after that, I remember hearing that he had a show coming to Comedy Central. And I was like, I'm here. I'm here for it all day. Watched that first one with the black white supremacist. And I watched it. And he came back the next week. And after that first show, I told people, like, you've got to watch the show. I've never seen anything this good. This show is hilarious. And the next week he comes back and he's like, I can't believe we're still on the air. And I'm thinking, like, I can't believe it either. I don't know how you got that first episode through. And after that, I was a diehard fan ever since.
Yeah. The Prince stuff, the Charlie Murphy stuff sticks to me, like lives rent free in my brain. God bless them both. I just was at Paisley Park a couple weeks ago. That was where I went for a road tour. And there's like, as soon as you go to Paisley Park, you go down the biggest Prince rabbit hole of your life. And then you come across Dave Chappelle every third video on YouTube Shorts. And it's just that story on repeat. But then a Prince one comes up and someone's interviewing him, like some fucking high collar asshole interview. And Prince is like, oh, yeah, I asked him to play ball. Oh, yeah, I'm better than him. Oh yeah, I outshot him. Like, and he just he Prince tells the story so beautifully because it's like Chappelle's version is the best version, but he's just so matter of fact about it. Man, fuck, I miss
that. He's my favorite musical artist, probably of all time. Just like brilliant. He's absolutely just plays every instrument, sings and writes everything. And I saw a doc on him where he was recording Purple Rain, the album, and he told his engineer, he's like, I think we're going to start a little later tomorrow. So let's start around 8, 9 o'clock. So you can get a little rest. It's late. He's like, only way we're going to come in here early is if I dream a song. He called the engineer at 4 a.m, like, get to the studio. I dreamed a song. And I'm like, what the fuck? I was like, wow. Yeah.
They take you into the recording studio and they isolate the two instruments that are encased in solid plastic to keep them from dying and aging. And it's the first synthesizer that he used and the first keyboard. And then they play When Doves Cry and then they isolate that instrument doing its job and how he ripped the bass out of it. And like, the candles are lit. It's all purple. Like they left everything just fucking immaculate. Then they take you through the 12,000 square foot soundstage. You see where he made pancakes for everybody at 2 a.m. Like it's just a fucking trip down memory lane. But I just love how the dude figured out how to screw the music business. Like with the artist, I always thought the artist thing was an artistic endeavor. Right. I didn't know anything. And I was young at the time. But then you find out when you go there and you're like, well, Warner Brothers owned him and he didn't want to be owned anymore because he says, if you don't own your masters own you, which is such a good quote. And he had enough music that he had just made, just fucking noodling around, that he still owed Warner Brothers 5 albums. So he just gave them second tier music that he just could give away. and then got rid of those five albums. But Warner Brothers was like, well, the contract's for 10 years. So the contract was under the Prince identity, which is what forced him into becoming the artist. And then midnight, 10 years later, the day of the contract expiring, he wakes up the next day and goes, I'm now going to be Prince again because I own Prince. Prince is now me.
I did not know that.
Like, it's a brilliant motherfucker. And then, like, the Super Bowl performance in Miami when it starts to rain and he's like, can you make it rain harder? Like, I'm going to walk around the stage and play electric guitar in a rainstorm. You're fucking insane, man. And they had the shoe room, Haji. Holy shit. You walk in, Prince starts playing. There's like 30 pairs of shoes in the wall. There's this constant B-roll of all of the guys who made his shoes over the years. He got to the point where he would just make his own shoes. He'd come into the shoe shop with the guy and he'd give him a hammer and like would put on gemstones and all that shit on his own. Like he just wanted to make everything.
Jesus. Wow. Did you ever
go to it?
Did you ever see that Kevin Smith talk about when he was shooting that doc with Prince? Yeah, you seen it?
How he didn't?
I thought that thing was hilarious. But go ahead.
That story is one of my favorite Kevin Smith stories. But when I was walking through, I was like, "Where was Kevin when he didn't sign the agreement? Where was Kevin when he didn't sign the NDA?" That's what I was trying to figure out the entire time because I'm like, he has all that footage and nowhere to put it.
Yeah.
So brilliant. No, so brilliant. Okay, so you take the special. I like that. I think that's like that's a tool, right? And like what is it about, like there's two comedians on the show, Jimmy and Martin, and I've only performed a handful of times live with this show so far. And I grew up performing in theater and musical arts and shit like that. But is it the world giving you all their attention? Is it the laughter in the room? Is it just having a space to get your shit out? Like, what's the therapeutic aspect to your writing and your comedy?
For comedy, it's a purity to it. It's probably the most pure thing where, like, when I'm doing, like, I probably have the most fun, it's most difficult, but most fun working out new material or trying stuff out on audiences. But once it's, like, I know, like, all this stuff works, it's just really just fun, having fun with the audience and kind of making them laugh and doing off kilter things. So there's like a purity of fun to it. Also, it's pure for me because I don't really like talking that much in general. And when I'm on stage, I have to talk, but it's everything I want to talk about. And no one can like change the subject and be like, screw this guy, because you don't have a choice. I'm sitting there with a microphone. So it's a little bit of a comedic bully to an audience, which is a little fun. It's like a little dominance. And it's also just a pure, because laughter is an innate thing. So there's a purity to it. There's no like room for subjective BS, I guess, to come out of it. It's pure like, oh, this was funny. It made me laugh. And you know it immediately. You don't have to think about it. It doesn't have to be edited. It's just there.
No, I totally agree with you. Like I in its purest form, you're taking people down a journey into ideas and patting the landing with laughter so you can talk about them.
Exactly.
Right? Because some of watching the brilliance of the best like take you so far, and at the end you're like, all right, we can all breathe now. We're fine, right? We're all still friends. Don't jump on stage and beat the shit out of me. Don't go crazy. Like it's fine. How much of what, like, because you started with stand up and then like how soon after you got to LA were you trying to write for shows, or did you do stand up for a good chunk of time and then that kind of like you made connections and then you start talking to people and then you can start pitching? Like, when did the actual wanting to write take place?
This is like a kind of, I guess I gotta structure this properly, right? Because when I was in Montessori school and like all my teachers from first through sixth grade had all said that they thought I would be a writer when I grew up. Cause I used to write like, I guess novella length, like stuff in like third and fourth grade. I read like Stephen King in like fourth grade, Dean Koontz. So I enjoyed writing stories all the time and before I'd ever written a joke. So for me, when it came to writing, writing a feature length or a half hour comedy was almost as natural as writing jokes. I remember my managers and agents saying like, I would write like a 30 minute, like the thing that got me signed to the CA and Three Arts was a spec script of Eastbound and Down, where basically I just had Kenny Powers had to teach sex ed. It was after the first Eastbound and Down. And
dude, I got to cut you off there. We have a debate where we use Arnold Schwarzenegger to teach sex ed.
I like that. That's all.
What Arnold Schwarzenegger character could teach sex ed? I'll tell you right now, Conan the Barbarian one. Go on.
So, I guess the speed, like I wrote that spec script in like 36 hours. And I would have wrote it in one day, but I went to do comedy that night. So I finished it the next morning. So everything, like I write stuff fast. Like I've written, I think it takes me about fully done, like 30 days to write a feature film. And for like a pilot or a half hour, it's basically 72 hours. And for a spec, it's faster because I know the characters and everything.
So is spec usually where you audition? Is that where you kind of get noticed, right? You write your own version of what you think should be done, submit it to an agency, and then they're like, hey, this could actually have legs.
Yeah, that's how it works theoretically. But here's how it worked for me. Well, basically, I wrote that Eastbound and Down spec. I sent it into a contest, and it went like top 10 or something, so I won some money for the contest. But a couple of the producers were like, hey, you need to get this script to 3 Arts or Mosaic. Mosaic's Will Ferrell's management outfit. I think not his personally, but like it's the second biggest. Or like that and 3 Arts are like neck and neck. And I was like, okay. So I told the guys the contest, can you get it to them? And they're like, oh, sure, we have contacts there. So they send it to them and nothing happens for like 3-4 months. And then the second season of Eastbound and Down was coming out. And I'm like, well, this spec script's going to be kind of dead because they're going to season 2. So I hit up some friends. I had knew Rory Scovel, another comedian. He was he was represented by Mosaic, and he told me that he's like, they're not really looking for any specs. I'm like, okay, cool. And then Hannibal was with 3 Arts, and I'm like, hey, can you do anything with this? He's like, yeah. And he sent it to his guy and the guy under his guy. I think he was the Dave Becky. That's what he was under. It was the guy under Dave Becky, Josh Lieberman. He read it and loved it. So that's how I got signed. It was basically Hannibal had to hand it to him. Exactly. It wasn't like, oh, you just drop it off the office and they read it. No.
Hey, man, some people would think it's like you show up at the front desk. Would you make sure this gets to David Zaslav's desk, yeah, please? Like, you know,
it should be.
In a perfect world. Yeah, yeah, it should be. That's awesome, man. Like, I love Hannibal. He's just the stoicism in his comedy, like just the deadpan humor that he can bring is, and it's so smart and it's so quick. Did you tour with him at all? Did you open for him?
Right before we moved to New York. I don't know. We were Western Michigan and 2 other universities where I was opening up for him for a little bit. And we did some of the same shows in the city here and there, and we'd hang out too, and like he'd be hosting shows and I'd be on the show, so it was a little bit of touring, but mainly like pop-up gigs around Chicago.
What's the college scene like back then? Like, I mean, that's kind of, you know, I watched Crashing. That's where you cut your teeth, right? You can go into the depths of America, or you can do the college circuit. Like, what's more fun?
It kind of depends, because the college gigs, I mean, you're dealing with 18 to 22-year-olds for the most part.
So dick and fart jokes.
Exactly. And they're not as nuanced as like a full-bore audience at a comedy club. And also you might be doing a set at like 5 o'clock or 2 in the afternoon. And there's no alcohol being served. So it's a really different. And that was like, because I'd be opening up for them. So I try and kind of like feel out the crowd and kind of push some lines coming in, and you could feel like they'd be like tense, like, oh, he talking about that subject. And I'd be like, okay,
oh boy.
I give Hannibal a look so he'd know, like, okay, yeah, it's gonna be kind of like that. But then on the other side, you do comedy clubs are great in major cities. Like I say, if you have at least an NBA, MLB or NFL team, you're gonna be perfectly fine. But if you're in a little more rural area, if you step on some lines, they shut down. I've got example, like, the biggest one, I'm trying to, I'll save that one for a second. But where was that? Madison, Wisconsin. That's where University of Wisconsin's at. But I did a lot of shows up there, and the headliners kept telling me, like, the one thing you can't do with an audience there, you can't do anything about religion or politics, or they just inherently shut down, unless you're like Bill Maher or someone big, where like they're there to see them. But at a comedy club, they're just there for comedy. They just, their buttholes tighten up, and it, and I witnessed it happen, where like guys would try and get political or talk about the Bible, and the audience would just shut the fuck up. And I'd be like, oh, this guy, he was not incorrect. Yeah. And then the biggest one, I remember I was, there was a club in Milwaukee, JD's, I don't think it's there or it changed his name. It was ran by some like Hell's Angels guys or something. Or like, they were like, not, it was Hell's Angels, the Outlaws, which is why they like me, because of my last name. Like, oh, Outlaws here. They were like, the Outlaws. Yeah. But I used to do stuff there and I'd get away with a bunch because it was, Milwaukee's great. There was another club like four exits out in like Brookfield, Wisconsin or something. And I remember I had this deadpan joke where it was kind of like Conan O'Brien's in the year 2000, these one-liners. And in one part of the joke, I say George W. Bush will lose a spelling bee to a jar of pickles. And at JD, it goes over great.
You just lost them.
This audience, they were like, nope, we're not laughing. And my next joke was,
nope,
Barack Obama will become the first black president of Mexico. And that meant uproarious laughter. And I had to stop and be like, oh, I guess we know who you guys are voting for this year. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, so W. Obama,
take his plane right over Brookfield. Doesn't need to stop here. But that was just like a difference between like four exits. And so that can happen at comedy clubs too, which
wow.
That's why like someone like Chappelle pretty much needs to be in a bigger city to have a diverse audience for it to work. I have one of my good buddies, Derek, he saw him at, he was at Carthage College, it's like Kenosha, Wisconsin. And Chappelle came there, this was like maybe a few years after Half Baked, but he wasn't in like a main room, he was like a side room. And they said they gave him carte blanche, he could say whatever he wanted. And he saw him, was like, he was great, but like he couldn't do a bigger like auditorium than like Bob Saget or someone would be at, which, by the way, I heard Bob Saget makes a lot doing college gigs, or did make a lot.
Oh, I'm sure, man. Like that, what is it? The bit, the Aristocrats.
Yeah. It's great. That's great.
Yeah. Bit. Like, may he rest, but like nobody could take it as far. Like, I take my wife's breasts and I bang them into a drawer, and then I take my kid's hair and pull it out and stuff it in my wife's mouth. Like, my God, you're America's fucking dad, dude. Calm down.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a good film. Good film.
That's, All right. Yeah, no, I always, because like the Pete, what's his face from Crashing? Pete Holmes. His whole bit of doing college gigs, I was like, I would imagine that would be a fun lay of the land. But now that you're telling me about it, it's like you do want that diversity, you want that age gap, you want that, you know, median income, upper middle class. You want everybody in the room kind of melding on the idea instead of, you know, dick and fart jokes running the whole night. So you're writing, you get the book out. Did you get the book out before you got Eric Andre, or did that kind of happen at the
books,
same time?
They were like different volumes. It was before. I think I had maybe two or three volumes out before I got Eric Andre. Yeah.
So are you doing like a Stephen King thing where like you do another volume and a bunch of different stories and another volume and a bunch of different stories?
Exactly. I think the first four or five were all like original stories. Then I have like a couple that are just shorter, and what they're like, they're completely made up, but I make them seem like they're in, I write them like they're true stories. Like they're just like topical. Like one of them was like, when Harvey Weinstein met Donald Trump, and they basically end up 69ing each other. Yeah. And then there's one where like, somehow I met Harrison Ford, like at the bar, and I met him, and he takes me to these underground like actor fights, to determine who gets starring roles. And they have to fight, and all the young actors have to fight like completely naked in front of the entire like producers and agents and everything. So it's like underground Hollywood. So I did a little bit of fiction in there at certain points.
Yeah, are we sure that's nonfiction?
That's what I keep telling people. Are like, that seems very believable. I'm like, yeah, that's why I wrote it. It feels like that could be believable.
Yeah. Where's the Blood Boy? When does the Blood Boy come out for Harrison to keep him young?
Exactly.
So, like, how many bars did you work in over the course of your? I take you don't do it anymore, or is it just for shits and giggles? Yeah.
How many? Let's see. You do eight, maybe five or six. It was mainly two or three. Like the first year was that house bar and grill in Venice, and then it was two in the same company that was probably 75% of the stores, which is Bar Lubitsch and El Carmen. They're owned by the same company. Then I'd fill in some other nights, some other spots around town here and there.
And the insane riders, the private room insanity that can go down in some of these. Is there anything you can mention about XYZ? I'm not here to get a scoop, but you could be like this person. You don't have to say.
I'll say their name. I have no problem with that.
Oh, sweet. Okay, great, man. Go ahead.
So let me think. Like celebrity stuff. Andy Dick.
Oh boy.
He came by Lubitsch a few times, and he was sober the first couple. And I was like, oh, cool, Andy Dick. And then a couple of times he was like loaded, and he came in there like, I think one guy threw a punch at him because he kept like grabbing guys by the dick that he didn't know, just going by and grabbing guys. And they had to kick him out. It was like, I remember I was coming in and I'm like, why are they walking Andy Dick out? Like, he sat on the curb and he fell asleep on the curb for like 3 hours. He was not moving. Like people were lining up to get into the bar and they're like, is that Andy Dick? And I was like, yeah, that's Andy fucking Dick. So that was there. This is a funny story. It's in the book. The time I met Matt Damon. It was a trainer had a big party. This is around the time after Elysium came out. But it was something like who's a major trainer who lived in the area. He was having a party. So like Topher Grace, some other celebrities were already in there. Me and other bouncer guy, Connor, were at the door, and the black SUV pulls up a little bit down the block. Guy hops out, and it's like girl with him. And I'm like, as he's walking up, I'm like, wow, that guy kind of looks like Matt Damon. And he gets right up there, and I'm like, oh, that's fucking Matt Damon. So I'm thinking like, you know, I'm letting this guy right in. Like, I know who you are. You're Matt Damon. I'm letting you in. Connor's like, hold on, I need to see your ID. And I was like, what the fuck? But Matt Damon did not bat an eye. He was like, oh, sure, here you go. Wife showed the ID. And he's like, okay, go on in. And I'm like, you're not going to just let Matt Damon walk in?
This fucking Goodwill
exactly.
Hunting motherfucker.
And then, like, the bartender, all the female bartenders at the end of the night, they're like, oh, my God, I thought he'd be hotter than that. He's not as tall as I thought he would be. Oh, his wife isn't that hot. And they're like, he should have tipped more. And I'm like, wait a second. He stayed for like an hour. He bought rounds for everyone. They said it was like $100 tip on whatever it was after he bought a round for everyone in his group. And I'm like, what more do you want from the guy?
Yeah, I think he understood the assignment.
He did everything perfect. And they complained. And like another one, also a good one, Billy Zane and Gerard Butler and two of their other friends who I don't know, they were riding bicycles. I think we're coming from like downtown LA late night. I think back to like Santa Monica or something like that. Just late night bicycle ride. So that they get to like our bar at like 1:30, right around last call. None of them drink either. I think Gerard's sober. I think maybe he used to drink or something. So they're all on bicycles. They come in and they're like, hey, can we leave we have a big patio. Like, can we leave our bikes on your patio? I'm like, it's still pretty busy right now. No, but I'll keep an eye on it. They're like, oh, thank you very much. So they go inside. Once the patio clears out, I bring their bikes in, lock everything down. They stay late, just having some waters, chit-chatting with the staff. And at the end of the night, they thank me for like bringing their bikes in. Gerard gave me like $20, didn't know it to me. I'm like, okay, cool, not a problem, whatever. Then I find out from one of the other bartenders, one of the girls, like, oh my God, I got Gerard Butler's phone number and I'm gonna go talk to him. I'm like, okay, let me know how that goes. 2 weeks later, she's like, he won't call me back. I'm like, what did you do? She's like, well, I sent him a picture of my ass. And I'm like, this guy's basically doing every movie he does is $50 million. There's probably like 5 ass models on every fucking set. Why would you think that your ass is better than the professional ass models he's going to see and then be annoyed with them?
That's crazy, man. And I mean, after a while, like, I mean, you know, like a cop, you just get desensitized, right? Like it happens all the time, and then it becomes a book, and then it becomes great stories. And then, That's like, where can everybody find it?
Just type in my name or Hey Doorman.
Sweet.
One thing I would not, I'll tell you this other story was, I remember I was at that El Carmen spot when, what's the guy's, John Mayer was dating Katy Perry. Well, and the amount of paparazzi, I understand why celebrities hate paparazzi. They're like a Land Rover, a Range Rover or whatever. And as they're getting in their car, it's like 40 guys with cameras surround the entire car. Click, 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 click. They're like on the hood and the lights are so bright. They're blinding me. And I'm like 75 feet away. I'm like, how can they see? And like the maitre d' was trying to be like, all right, that's enough pictures. Get off the car. Let them go. They wouldn't let them go. Like John Mayer had to reverse down a whole block and spin around to get out of there because they would not get out from the front of his car. And I was just like, and then all the people follow wherever they're going. And I'm like, this is why people hate you guys.
Yeah, no, you're pariahs, yeah. You're cockroaches. You step on one and it survives and then has two friends right after it. Eric Andre, the talk show that maybe is a talk show, maybe isn't a talk show, maybe is planned, maybe isn't planned. How does this land in your lap? Where does this come from?
It started with Hannibal because Hannibal was a co-host for years on that. So I remember he came into LA, we grabbed lunch, and I don't know if I had told him, but he just said, he's like, do you want to submit anything for Eric? I can get it to him. And I'm like, cool. But I think like I knew Eric a little bit because I had gone to like, he used to live like a mile and a half from me, and he invited me like his birthday parties when he was like at a little shitty apartment. And then when he's like doing well, and it's like, he's like buy out the whole bar. So Hannibal basically like, hey, write a packet. So like 2-3 days later, I sent him the packet. He sent it to Eric Andre. He let me know. Eric responded, was like, I really love this bit. This is a bit. It was, I remember the bit was something like, it was going to be him dressed up as a ninja at a bus stop. And as the bus is pulling in, he throws like a smoke bomb down, and like everyone else goes like into the bus, but he stays there. When the bus leaves, you just see him still in his ninja mask eating a sandwich, and that was the whole thing. And he loved that.
That's
and
a good
like,
bet.
Oh, okay, good. But I didn't get it that next year. But I think the year after that, he called me up and was like, "What are you doing this Tuesday? Can you come to the writer's room?" And I was like, "Yeah, I can do that." So I ended up writing for the season, I think it was season 5.
Oh, so well into it. Yeah. It's been budgeted. It's doing its thing. What's a writer's room like that like? Like we...
It was actually very professional. It was nothing crazy or kooky. It was just like, I think it was 12 of us, one or two of the directors, because they're brothers. And we just kind of pitched ideas. He'd have like certain topics up on a board that he was looking to do. So we'd pitch ideas for that. And then he had like 3 or 4 or 5 subjects. He'd be like, I want you to watch these videos or YouTube clips. I'm thinking of doing something along this line, pitch ideas for this as well. And then I think he had like a short film or something we watched, and we just throwing out jokes for that. I think after lunch, we went to the park and just kind of hung out in the park for a while, and then pitched a couple more ideas, jokes like that, came back to the office for like 45 minutes, had some snacks, and he's like, all right, I think that's good for the day. I'm like, oh, okay, no, that was it. And kept doing that. And that was really about it. And I still am baffled. I don't know. I can't see what I directly wrote leading to any of the episodes, but I could see ideas for it all around, but nothing I directly wrote, like that ninja sandwich thing. It was nothing ever that clear ever went anywhere, but like vague ideas of stuff I was writing or pitching jokes for were intertwined throughout, if that makes sense.
Is it intense as much as it's made out to be to us general laymans who don't know? Or, like, I mean, you go to the park, you write. Like, I imagine a good creative environment is one that is full of as little stress as possible, where, you know, all ideas are listened to. Not all of them make it, but, you know, everybody kind of gives everybody's thing. Like, do you a lot of and thens, or do you each kind of go into your separate corner and come up and then pitch as a group? Like, what's the dynamic to get heard?
Literally one by one, like, you just have everyone kind of go around the table and pitch an idea. And we really didn't break into groups a little bit. I know there were some other writers who came in late from other spots. Like, some people show up like 11 or 1 because they had other gigs or whatever. So it was like a loose, you know, they want your perspective from each person there to have your perspective thrown into the mix for everything. So no one was really in their own silo or like a group thing. It was just like, hey, I think your comedy's good. I think your perspective's good. Give me your pitch for this, or give me a pitch for that. That's kind of the way it was set up. And it was really loose. It wasn't uptight or like really intense or anything. I don't really know too many rooms that are like sometimes you might have a showrunner who is, I've heard, like, just kind of a dick, who's like demanding of this and that. But for the most part, I think it's pretty, most of the rooms I've been in, they're pretty chill. And most stuff I read about or hear about people, they're like, generally speaking, the room's pretty chill. Like, if you have a deadline, yeah, things get tense. You have to be there late. But other than that, pretty chill.
What was one of your most memorable moments on the show? Like, were you like, okay, what are we doing now?
My most memorable one was one that never made the air. I was just there when he was taping it. It was this scene where it never made the air, but it was Rick Fox was the guest, former Laker. And they had a rim set up. So they had him shooting around, and Eric's trying to block his shot and do all this stuff. And Rick's, you know, Rick's like 6'7", 6'8". He's like, come on, I'm going to do that. And then he lets Eric shoot around, and Eric's bricking this and that. And like, Rick Fox is just like nonchalant, totally chill. And then they're like, all right, we're about to tape a scene. And Eric goes to shoot a shot, and Rick Fox just leaps up, just like, boom, and slant, like, blocks the shit out of his shot, almost breaks the camera. And Eric's just like, what the fuck? He's just like, and Rick just starts laughing. He's like, I've seen your show. I was dying. I was like, that's gotta make the show. Never did.
Fuck all that shit on the cutting room floor. And like, okay, so, you know, the Jackass environment of never knowing what bit is coming, but that's stunts and that's pain and that's insanity. Was that kind of environment too? Like, you, everything was fair game. Anything could be a bit. Or was there
pretty much. I've seen him. He has an idea of kind of which direction he wants to go, but depending on the guest and depending on the way, it's a lot of it's done in the editing, the way that they edit it. But it depends. Like, I remember the second season, I think I was there for the taping. It was like one of the guests didn't know how the show was, so she was getting freaked out. She was like her agent in the green room, being like, what the fuck did you get me into? What is this thing? This is going to ruin my career. So I had to, what directors were telling like Eric in his ear, like, all right, can you calm down just for a minute or two and get her on something like a minute or two from now? We'll edit out all the nice BS stuff you're going to do, but we need to calm her down so we can keep her here. Cause if she leaves, we don't have another option here. So you had to watch him kind of like, all right, I'll chill out, have like a regular talk show for a minute. Then he'd like do 2-3 nice things and like do something weird, or Hannibal would do something weird and it would freak her out. But that's what they would use in the editing for the actual interview.
Oh, that's interesting. So they anticipate a reaction based. Okay. Yeah. That's smart. So that you can cut it and then you still got your shit. Oh my God. Like, is Two Ferns and him kind of running at the same time, or did he kind of take, because Two Ferns is solid bit where Andre is like genuine, gives a shit, and then next thing you know, just switches on you, which I think is worse to be in. You know, like, if you fully know you're going into it, you just have to not
pretty
break.
I think they were on about the same time. I don't know which one was first. But yeah, his is more, because it's wild. It's just so many wild things happening on that show. It's a whole environment, and like, I would like to be in the editing room when they do it, because it's an art the way they do that. Because I've been on set and watched them do a whole like segment And then you see it on TV and you're like, whoa, you guys edited the crap out of this to make it better than what it was. So it's his environment. The environment there is just on set is just weird. And Eric handles it really masterfully because he knows by feel like when he needs to really ramp it up or pull back a little bit or go left field crazy or understand and tell the directors, this part right here, we need to cut to something super weird later on in editing. So it's like a constant, like you're making pottery at all times, even as you're shooting, like he's molding it in a different way and they mold even more in editing.
Wow.
So it's a real touch and go. Like it's really him. It's really him and the directors. I guess they're the brain trust of it that make it what it is.
And he just, like, I don't know any history on the show, but he just was like, I'm done. I'm good. I want to try something else after it ended.
I'm not sure. I never asked him about it. I know I don't know what his checks were, but I know from some other people, the checks from the network weren't that great. So they were just kind of like, if it comes back, whatever, this is not going to make my day. I know that the Adult Swim gives him autonomy to do, for Eric to do what he wants to do. They give him a locked in budget. They're like, you can create what you do, what you do. So I don't know if he walked away or if it was just, I want to say after season 4 or 5, I think he said he was like, I think I might be kind of done. And then he takes some time off and he's like, I want to do it again. But then he's got to go talk to Adult Swim and get the ball rolling again. So
if there was someone you could write a sketch with, who'd be your dream writing partner to sit down for a sketch?
It would probably be Chappelle. Number one would probably be Chappelle. I know Larry David did not enjoy his time in SNL very much, so I can't really use him. Or Key and Peele. Chappelle or Key and Peele.
Those
probably be the top two. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. That would be, that's fun. Mm-hmm. That's a good show. As someone, you probably started, like when you started writing, I don't think the animated world was as popular as it was back then, or was it?
It was something that
wasn't as big
as it is now, I don't think.
And Adult Swim, I think probably Adult Swim and Comedy Network are the two culprits to really push that and to get outside of your normal adult cartoons, right? Adult Swim, literally late night cartoons that no child should ever see. Is that kind of the way the comedy writer landscape is going? Like the animated show is either the sketch show or the animated show or the hot tickets, the ones that you want to be on because there's so much you can do there and there's so many eyes watching.
I think that's probably the best venue. Like I remember when I started kind of writing, like 30 Rock was really big. That was one of my favorite shows. But since then, like especially network comedy is so boring at this point. Like for me to watch something, it basically needs to be on premium cable, maybe on regular cable, or it's Adult Swim. That's pretty much it. And what they do creatively on that Cartoon Network Adult Swim brand seems like the most fun you can possibly have as a writer. Like Rick and Morty is still like, they can do just about anything they need or want to do. And they can do it so in such a super intelligent way, a super absurd way, super crazy way, and kind of spin it back on itself like a dog eating its own tail. Everything it seems like so much fun as a writer to create those.
Yeah, it reads that way across the room because the bits and the reactions and the lines are just like, who's coming up with this? And how much fun are you fucking having while you're doing it? I mean, there's a lot to say there about Rick and Morty right now with the loss of what the hell's his name? It doesn't matter. Yeah. Justin Roiland. There we go. Yeah. Is there chatter that someone can take that mantle? Cause
I think it's toast. I don't think you can really, I know they're going forward with more, at least one more season without, but I don't know how you make that show work without him. I really, it's gotta be something completely revamped. But I've also heard that he was really kind of off in his own silo and didn't really like, writers would write a bunch of stuff and he'd be like, no, that's garbage. I'll do it this way. So there was I heard there was a lot of that going on as well. So it seems like it's more him than anything else. So I don't know how they're going to be able to work it without him involved. I just don't know. I think it'll be a very different show.
Do you think the fans will allow it? Or do you think there'll be fandom at the gates?
The fan base is so rabid. I'm leaning towards it. It might be a bit of a revolt. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah, because that's a rabid fan base.
Is there a character that you like to write the most? Is there a story you like to incorporate?
Not really. There are like a typo or a type of character I want to write. The type I like to write are basically power characters, or what I call them. That's that Danny McBride type of character. Those guys who are like ridiculously confident, kind of like Larry David, where Larry David, his character, says stuff that he says like, I don't say that. I think that, but I don't say it. I enjoy writing those type of characters. And I guess there are certain characters just in movies and I guess in TV that I've ever seen that I just really love. And I think you see parts of it in my writing. One of them is Ron Swanson on Parks and Rec. Probably one of the five best like comedy characters on TV history. He's just unbelievable. Everything he said was gold. John McClane, Die Hard, that type of character. I already said Larry David and Danny McBride. I'd say if I'd ask anything about characters I write, oh, Jules from Pulp Fiction. Yeah.
Ooh. yeah, okay. Yeah,
Tarantino
is
like my
now.
Favorite writer. So I think if I write something, I'm inherently like, I'm thinking, would Tarantino respect this? I think that innately.
Do you think he's going to do 10 and then walk away, or do you think this is one of the biggest long cons in movie cinema?
I think he's going to stick to it. I've heard he's been writing the 10th one. I haven't heard any. I think it's something cinema based. I'm hearing rumors about that.
Yeah, it's about a film critic.
So I think he's going to do that. And I heard he has some deal with Netflix to do like some kind of docuseries or something. And I know he's doing plays and he's written a couple books now. So I think he's comfortable leaving on his 10th. I think he'll just do the 10, and maybe 10 years later he'll jump and want to do an 11th. I don't know.
Like a one-off, one night only kind of, you know, who should we get to direct this? And he was going to do a Star Trek thing. Can you imagine if Tarantino did Star
Trek?
Good.
And I heard Chris Pine was like, please, please left. Cause he wanted to have Chris Pine as Kirk again. Pine was like, oh, please.
Oh, really?
Please let that happen. Yeah. But it never.
I'm going through your list of everything you told me you watch, and we watch the same stuff. Like, you're a Scorsese nut, you're a Nolan nut, you're a Tarantino nut. I am all three of those things in spades. Did you Barbenheimer or did you just Oppenheimer?
I got plans to probably go see Barbie maybe this weekend with a chick. But I just saw Oppenheimer on Sunday. And good.
What were your thoughts?
Very, very good. I'm kind of amazed like how Nolan, like that movie should not have been as entertaining as it was just off the premise of it. To make that a 3-hour movie, which it maybe had one little lull for a little bit, but he got through it like right on to the next thing. And it might have been within the first hour or so, hour and a half, right in that area where maybe it lulled just a little bit. And then it was like, you're good. And what he did there was pretty, pretty amazing for what that premise was. It was excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. No, dude, I gave it a solid 10 out of 10. Barbenheimer. That's a thing. No, we did Barbie at noon and then we did Oppenheimer at 6 and took like a 2.5 hour break in between. You're going to enjoy it. Like there's a ton of adult humor in it. It's got a great monologue from America Ferrera. Like we get beat up in it as dudes, but the comedy is there. Ryan Gosling steals the fucking show. Like you're just going to be laughing your head off. Oh yeah. As Ken, I went into it being like, what are we going to expect? And then as soon as it has the Barbie world and the human world, they're very, very aware of the fact that Barbie lives in the fake world And now she's going to find out who she is in the real world. And Ken's like, well, I want to go too. So it's the two of them navigating the real world, even the real world Mattel, the real world Barbies, the women in the world of Barbie. But they're so naive because in Barbie world, Barbies can be anything and Kens are nothing. And in the real world, Kens have too much and Barbies are trying to make a name for themselves, so to speak. So that's the arguing back and forth with it. With Oppenheimer, though, I have never waited for one explosion for so long in my entire life. Right? Like, and I knew the story. I know, like, Oppenheimer and the story of the bomb is one of the most interesting aspects of history for me. And I've watched, like, my YouTube feed is just nothing but, like, Oppenheimer and atomic bomb porn now. That's all it is. And to sit there, like, as the bomb was counting down, me and my friend Tony just kept, like, going off of our seat, getting close. Like, I could feel myself, like, trying to get into the explosion. And I'm like, this should not be this entertaining for one bomb, right? And no war. It's just the story of a guy who got fucked around. And, like, how about that scene when Damon shows up and he puts the two bombs in the back of the truck and he's like, have a nice life.
He's like, I'll try and get back to you on this information if I can or whatever. Like, wow. Like, okay.
Favorite Nolan, favorite Scorsese, and favorite Tarantino, and then I will let you go.
Favorite Nolan movie. I want to say Dunkirk. Yeah.
Really? That's a hot take, actually.
It's been jumbling around a lot because I love Inception, but I don't really watch it much anymore. What I remember when I saw Interstellar in the theater, telling myself as I was walking out, that might be the worst Christopher Nolan movie I've seen, and it's still better than 98% of the films out. About 3 months later, I caught it again, and then when it hit my cable and I saw it, I was like, wow, I was off. This might be that was great. But Dunkirk was the one, like, immediately I was like, this is amazing. This was like the feeling of it, because there's not much dialogue. It's just the feeling of, like, you take one step forward, three steps back, and it's everything's coming at you. I thought that was absolutely great. But I have to, Interstellar is probably my top four now of his. It's so easy. He said top Scorsese. My favorite Scorsese film is Casino. I like Casino more than
Good man.
I like it more than Goodfellas. And I recognize Goodfellas is a better movie. I still love Casino more. It can't change. Nicky Santoro, Joe Pesci, that character when he's in the scene with the banker at De Niro's flight, he's like, let me tell you what I do for a living. I'm gonna come down to the bank and you don't have money, I'm gonna crack your fucking face open, crack your head open. That scene is brilliant. The scene when they're in the desert, they meet. Don't never go over my head again, you fucking Jew, you. I love that. Other than, if it wasn't Casino, that's my favorite, it'd probably be Raging Bull.
Nice. Yeah.
Or I could say Taxi Driver. It's a lot for Scorsese, but, like, those would be my, Casino's my favorite, then Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas. You know, duke it out, I guess, the number two spot there. Favorite Tarantino. It's really had three types of films. Like, Reservoir Dogs kind of stood on its own. Pulp Fiction is its own thing, and there's other kind of versions of that. And then Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was, like, its own different type of film for him. My favorite, I almost want to say Inglourious Basterds. And that is just, it's grown on my... That opening 20 minutes with Christopher Waltz, after I saw that scene, I was sitting in the theater and I said to myself, okay, you got 90 minutes. You can do whatever the fuck you want to do, because that opening was unbelievable.
Yeah, dude. That is a lesson in dialogue and building suspense.
And, like, the multiple languages he had, like, that was heavy lifting. And I think that was the movie he did after Death Proof, which, by the way, I love with the... Yeah, that was a double joint feature with him and Robert Rodriguez, where he did Planet Terror.
Yeah, Death Proof and Terror. Yeah. Robert Rodriguez and everybody. Yeah, no, those.
That was,
yeah,
that Grindhouse. That's it. Yeah. That bomb. And then he comes back with Inglourious Basterds. And I was like, that was just super impressive to go about. That's three languages you're shooting, and you're pulling Christopher Waltz. No one knew who he was. And he's the breakout star of the, like, that. how he went about that in his career was like, it was like he was on his third life as a director after that movie.
Yeah, he did have a well, I mean, Pulp Fiction told the world what he could do, but Inglourious kept him relevant, I think. Yeah, those are solid picks, dude. I can watch Inglourious Bastards over and over and over again. The Ace Rothstein dancers. My God, that's one of my favorite parts of all of Casino. Where it's like, give it up, man. Get rid of your fucking dancers. Him with the fucking talk show.
Yeah.
So goddamn good. Yeah, Prestige is actually my top Nolan film.
I got no real argument. I've seen that movie probably four. I think I have it on DVD, so I've seen it way more than I think I saw it at least twice in theaters. Yeah.
It taught me how to still be surprised as a movie fan. It caught me off guard. Like, it's a big right hook when you're like, oh, that's wow. Okay. Really? That's what we're doing. This is because it really had me. I thought we had twins. I thought we were just making clones at one point. And that was what really captivated me. And then I just surrounded myself with everything he'd done before and then just have followed. I can sit in front of a Nolan movie and just shut your face. I'm in for 2.5 hours. Don't talk to me. I'm in church. Leave me alone. This is great. And it talks to me every time. And every, like, Batman talks to me differently than Dunkirk does, but Dunkirk is like, even Tenet, like, it took me 23 times, but ooh, I think I get it.
Yeah, the Tenet was one where, like, I really like what Denzel's John David Washington did in there, but at the same time, because I consider Denzel an actor of a generation, it also let me know, like, yeah, your son's not you, but he did a damn good job, so I can see why he was in there. And I love that movie. Like, I completely forgot about The Prestige when you said that one. There's a lot. Like, he's so meticulous, and he's so, I think I was talking to a buddy, Yasser, who's a, I think he's a showrunner now, but he's been a writer for a while. He talked about Nolan and how he'd watch scenes from afar, and he'd be like, it'd be like 150, 200 extras, and he'd be like, those two right there are doing like, you're like, what? Like, he's looking at the screens like, those two are doing something weird. Get them out of here. Get two other people. Change them or do something. I'm like, how are you noticing that type of stuff? I've heard Fincher's kind of like that. Matt Damon, I've heard that story. Matt Damon talks about the way some people walk in the background. He's just watching the scene. He's like, who the fuck walks like that? And the scene was ruined and they're in the background. So I don't know how you do that with, like, huge extras and everything there. That's pretty damn amazing.
Dude, I would love to keep you, but I'll keep my promise and get you the hell out of here. Thank you so much for
doing
this. Are you just hanging out in Chicago right now, putting shit together, making moves, or you got something on the go where anything people should know that you can promote?
Just check out the books. On. Just go to Amazon. Hey, Doorman. I got actually some. There's a series called This Movie Sucks. Since we're talking about, it's about major franchises that I shit on. Star Wars specifically in each volume. There's 3 volumes of it. The Matrix, which is my favorite movie of all time, by the way, but I shit on that one, that series as well. Basically just me shitting on different aspects of these major movie franchises. And I got some fiction stuff up there too as well.
Thanks for sharing your story with us, man. And just all the behind the scenes stuff. That's what we live for here. We're all cool nerds for that.
Happy
kind
to be
of
here. It was fun. Yeah.
I have been Michael Petro. My guest has been Haji Outlaw. Watch all the movies, kids. Say bye, Haji.
Yeah. Thank you.
If you have any problems, dial information. Thank you for calling.